has been the case in our talky bits here the last little while, a wee bit of a recap and then some continuing thoughts about the terrain we've been in. We've spent the last few weeks considering from a few different vantage points the scale of the place we call home and the bigger space in which we wrestle and make whatever belief systems we have. Tim's consideration of the vastness of space that when I was listening to Tim's podcast, he also was kind enough to send along the pictures that he'd used, which were a super important part, it felt to me, like of what he presented. I had this sensation when I was looking at the pictures and listening to the podcast of, you know, that shot that filmmakers have become so fond of, post-drone. I mean, it was there before, but now it's everywhere, where, you know, you start really close and then you just zoom out and zoom out and zoom out and zoom out. That sort of was the experience that I felt like I had with what Tim was doing, which was really interesting. And part of what it felt to me like, part of what Tim was sharing was some of the ways in which his own understanding of not just the universe, the physical space in which we do the things that we do, including live lives where we were conscious of our spirituality. But part of what he also felt like he was sharing was how his own understanding of the larger story that he lives in has changed over the years, which I also found really engaging and was really grateful for. It's not a no-brainer to stand in front of a group of people and share ways that your own beliefs have changed. Especially if the structure of those beliefs historically might have included some rather forceful insistence that changing aspects of what you believe amounts to ceasing to believe. So when you grow up in all or nothing systems and then you find that they're shifting, one of the enormous challenges you have to face is, what does the all or nothing nature of the belief system I was trained under, what does that mean? So I have conversations all the time with people who are having this experience and whose conclusion is they no longer have faith, which is a very logical conclusion. If you were taught that faith is an all or nothing, it has to be this way or it's nothing experience, it's also an enormously sad experience for me to hear people say that. It's also a hopeful experience because it's not what I believe and it's not what I've experienced. And so often in those conversations, I get to kind of wave the flag that says, you know, there might be another way to think about this. And that's a pretty fun thing to get to do. We talked a little bit last week about ways in which retelling the story that we have is an important part of this. Christianity, which is the religious tradition in which the table stands, is, among other things, a story. And to use a familiar framework, one of the things that means about the story of Christianity is that it has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end. And I realize there's other ways to think about story, but that's a fairly familiar one. So we're going to work with that just for a little bit. In terms of beginning, there was, of course, a time when there was no such thing as Christianity, which means it has a beginning. And if you think about the beginning of Christianity in terms of the time that we're aware of, the larger time frame, which is part of what I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, for the history of the planet, never mind the history of the species, one of the things that immediately becomes clear is that the history of Christianity is a very, very small portion of history. And it has a discernible beginning. I kind of alluded to some of this last week, but as far as the Christian story goes, the beginning of it's relatively well documented. It's what we generally call the New Testament. So this is the documented beginning of the thing called Christianity. And it's got a middle. This is trickier, for sure. If we're inclined to think of the middle of a story, the story of Christianity in this case, in terms of time, it's very difficult to know what to think of as the middle because we really don't know how this is going to play out. But it's probably reasonable to say that we're somewhere in the middle, right? That could change fairly quickly, that perception. But for the time being, that feels like a fairly reasonable way to think about Christianity. But about that end, no, I am not going to talk about the end times. God have mercy. The mess we have made trying to predict the end. Unbelievable. Talk about short-sighted hubris. Like, we can't successfully predict major weather events or seismic events, but we're going to predict the end of time. I don't think so. But we've got enough history with religions and the different ways that they behave over time to reasonably speculate that the Christian religion, having as it does a discernible historic beginning, will in all likelihood have a discernible historic end. By the way, saying that I believe that Christianity will likely have an end does not mean that I think that God will vanish. Nor does it mean that I believe that what we might call the way of Jesus will cease to be relevant. In fact, for me personally, the ongoing existence of God is the cornerstone of my faith. Without that, I wouldn't have faith. For me, those two are inextricably interwoven. And the way of Jesus is my best shot at imagining how to live that faith out. So both those things feel deeply relevant to me, and they don't feel remotely assailed by the idea that the thing we call Christianity might come to an end. That's how I experience that. And the reason I experience it that way is because I don't think that God lives inside the stories that we tell about God. I think it's the other way around. So let me unpack that just a little bit. After our gathering 2 weeks ago, Reese and I were chatting for a bit. And Reese is, among other things, somebody who deals with large numbers all the time. And so I had confessed in that talky bit how baffling I found these enormous numbers. And Reese came up to me afterwards and basically said he didn't find them baffling at all, which was, I kind of had this infantilizing experience, you know, of what kind of idiot am I? Actually, not at all, because Reese is a gracious human being. But he works with big numbers, and he's comfortable with the numbers. And the numbers freak me out. The other thing about Reese that I've learned over the years that him and his family have been here is that he's like many people in this community, he's someone who reads and thinks, which is how lovely, you know, to be surrounded by people who are auguring into what they believe all the time. And one of the things that we ended up talking about in that conversation was this picture of the relationship between the nature of God and the nature of humanity that really stuck with me. Reese credited the image that he told me about then and that I'm going to tell you about in a moment, he credited to the thinker, writer, podcaster, philosopher, all things, Pete Rollins. Rollins is somebody, by the way, that I'm happy to commend. I think that Rollins is one of the brightest lights in the conversation about faith, spirituality, and religion and culture at the moment. Just a really interesting, intelligent voice in that conversation. In any case, Rollins suggests that when it comes to thinking about where we are relative to where God is, one of the pictures that might be helpful is to think about God as being like an ocean. If God is like an ocean, we are the ship that has sunk in the ocean and is on the bottom. We're in it, we're surrounded by it, we're suffused by it. It's our entire environment. We're not it. We're distinguishable from it. So we can speculate about it if we want, then that's a lovely exercise, but got to keep some perspective when we do that, right? So that's a short version. It's a rich illustration that we could explore for a long time. Like any image that we use to talk about God, this one starts with its limitations. God is like is always a limiting opening statement, right? It's what we have to work with, so that's fine, but let's just call it what it is. It's limited. This is an image of God. This is not the image of God. I think that's important. I find that particular image helpful when it comes to trying to picture what it might mean that God isn't constrained by the images we make. That doesn't mean that the images that we make are not helpful. They are. They're helpful when it comes to trying to picture what it might mean to think about our self relative to God's being. Those images can help us engage. That's important. We need that. Without these kinds of things, metaphors, other kinds of things we imagine about God, I think we might be inclined to sort of one of two poles pretty easily. One is either overconfidence, we've got this. The other pole, without some handles for God, is, I think, pretty easily we can come to the sense that there's really no sense probing something that's always going to remain a mystery. Like, and depending on our personality and our experience, I was talking to a family member of mine the other day who's, by his own confession, somebody who prefers the concrete. And I think he does a pretty good job of imagining things myself, but that's his perspective on himself. And it's like, I like things that I can put my hands on and do something with. And we were talking about a really difficult family situation that you couldn't do that with. in that conversation. He was confessing his frustration about it. If our personalities are wired up like that, and some of us are, then some of that image making can feel just really frustrating. We want to get our hands on something. I had a conversation with someone last week who was like, basically, when I want to know that I have faith that's alive, I do something for somebody. That's when I feel like I'm connected with God. So, what could I do? This was this woman's question. Because if I can't do something, we can talk till the cows come home, and it's not going to do a thing for me. I got to get my hands on it. So we need different kinds of images, different points of access, so that we don't fall off the path either on the side of hubris of we've got this or on the side of despair. There's no sense wrestling with this. So we need those access points. And one of the very important things that we do to access God in our imagination is by retelling the stories that we already have. As a species, we keep learning and experiencing new things, and sometimes the impact of those new things is pretty enormous. The terrain that we've been exploring the last couple of weeks is a good example of that, but history is full of these. And just to pick a few of the sort of writ large examples in the history of Christianity, because that's sort of the broader frame that we've been in the last few minutes. When Galileo, for example, redrew the model of our solar system and displaced Earth from the middle of it, which had been the diagram up to that point, he got put on house arrest, like he got locked up. And the people who locked him up were the church fathers. They were the leaders of Christianity at the time. Because he was screwing with the system of belief. It's unnerving. Can't be right. Entire systematic theologies had been built on the idea that the earth is at the center of the system, the solar system. And when Galileo was able to point out that was not the case, all those systems teetered and started to topple. And all the people who were vested in those systems felt that teetering and toppling, created enormous uncertainty. What shall we believe about God if the earth isn't the center of the universe? It's kind of funny looking backwards, isn't it? Until you realize that we're having the exact same experience. It's just not around that particular model. Darwin comes along and makes sensible to the populace his theories about evolution and our own origins as a species, and that really rocked the boat, and arguably it's rocking still, but mostly who's keeping it rocking at this point is, guess what, some segments of Christianity. And then when we get our first glimpses of Earth from space and we saw just how finite this ball of dust is, and people had predicted this, by the way. I can't remember what the source was, but I was reading recently where somebody basically in a what now looks terribly obvious way, but what then was prescient, basically said, when we get to see our planet from space, it's going to change the way we believe about the divine. And it has, and it does. And then we zoomed even further out as humans in our explorations, and we got this more generous glimpse of the magnitude of our surroundings, and the story about who we are in those surroundings was impacted again. Christian tradition stands deeply in the Hebrew one. Some people would argue that we've hijacked the Hebrew one. The Hebrew tradition has always had its explorers, and we follow in those footsteps if we stand in the Christian tradition ourselves. So just think about it this way. I mean, the Psalms, right? I love the Psalms partly because they're not prescriptive as much as descriptive. They're song lyrics and poems, and when they're art, a lot of them, and when you make art, you make space, right? And so, this is one of the reasons I keep coming back to the Psalms. Listen to this. And while you're listening to this, it's a familiar psalm, but while you're listening to it, try to imagine what the psalmist was thinking when they wrote it. Okay? There's no way to know if we're right. It's not the point. Try to imagine what the psalmist was thinking when they wrote this. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place. What is humankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? You've made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. Psalm 8, 3-6. For the psalmist, the idea that God is out there somewhere in space is a totally reasonable one. The psalmist has no idea what's out there in space. They have had no opportunity to observe what is in space, other than the exact same opportunity you and I have if we're laying on the lawn on our back on a dark night. That's all the information that they have to work with. So what's out there is rather a mystery. God is rather a mystery. Where would such a mystery logically reside where other things mysterious are? Out there. Right? It's just like ka-chunk. It totally makes sense. So, think about this for a moment. What might the psalmist have written? We're retelling the story, remember? What might the psalmist have written had they been able to see the pictures that Tim showed us of the space we occupy as a planet a couple of weeks ago? What might they have written about where God lives had they known what we know now about the age of the planet, about the brevity of humanity, about the intricacies and unpredictabilities of our subatomic makeup? What might the psalmist have written? They regarded taking the time to write down their observations, their speculations, their imaginations about the nature of God and God vis-a-vis humanity because they thought that stuff mattered in life. Let's just affirm that, shall we? This matters. The mistake is not that it matters. The mistake is that we look at what was written down by somebody who was acknowledging that these explorations matter, and we regard it as material fact. It's not. It's somebody trying to figure out something that reaches well beyond that. They're working with the tools that they have. Who said we get to stop that? I kind of know the answer to that in terms of religious history. The people who had a vested interest in controlling the conclusion to the exploration historically are the people who said, time to stop exploring. It serves institutions well to have a last word. It does not serve explorers well to have a last word. It doesn't serve humanity necessarily very well to have a last word. Graham and I were having a conversation this morning about the nature of entrepreneurship. He's a good person to talk with about that. And about how the energy that comes from the exploration of the new. And Graham said something super salient and wise. I thought he just said, isn't it? It's the same way in relationships. It's the same way, and he used a number of different really important human illustrations in that conversation. That's right. If we start to operate in the world as though our fulfillment is pinned to arriving, oh my. Like, have we ever set ourselves up for just a horrendous disappointment? Because guess what? It doesn't matter what we think that arrival point is. When we get there, the experience we have of it will not be the one that we thought we were going to have if we thought that was the last word. And then what do we do with that sensation, right? I mean, this is just the story of human enterprise writ large. I thought this relationship would do that. I thought this particular accomplishment would do that. I thought this degree would do that. I thought this trip of a lifetime would do that. I could pick one. I thought listening to that song again would do that, right? You know, whatever. It just doesn't work. We're drawn to it, I think, in part because uncertainty terrifies us, you know? Like, that we'd kind of like that clenching feeling of I don't know to go away. And I think that the cynic, perhaps, maybe the astute cultural observer, you decide, but something inside of me says, in our culture, in our time, one of the huge reasons why we've started to believe that there's an end point to our explorations is because people who believe that are super easy to sell things to. Because then you can say, this thing is the end point. Or it's the next step to the end point. If you really want to be fulfilled, if you really want to be happy, you should buy it. In fact, you need to buy it. You need it. Because you're never going to have that experience you're longing for otherwise. If people are started looking at the world and going, no, this is actually open-ended and expanding, one of the logical implications of that is this thing is not actually going to make me happy. That doesn't make it a bad thing. It just makes it a thing that's not ultimate. So So we need to behave accordingly, right? Here's a question about the psalmist. If the psalmist had had access to the information about the evolved and evolving layers of the human brain, for instance, that we've been talking about the last few weeks, would they have still been, do you think, inclined to the top-down model of the cosmos that they carried? Big, broad strokes, history of the Hebrew people. The Hebrew people come into being as a people in Egypt. Before they get there, they're a family. They're basically a wee little tribe that ends up in Egypt because of events beyond their control. While they're in Egypt, they expand wildly to the point where, as we have the story in the Hebrew scriptures, they become a threatening presence to the Pharaoh and so on and so forth. When people groups develop in a cultural context, and I mean, I know Abraham arrives with a story of God saying you're going to be this mighty people and so on and so forth, super important Genesis story of its own kind, and some really unique things about the perspective of who God is happen in that story. Having said that, they arrive in Egypt. Egypt has its own spirituality in which they are operating, and they're not operating at a low level, right? If you read the story, man, they were in there. You can't do that as a human and not learn things about where you are, including spiritual things. So by the time the Hebrew people leave Egypt, they've been soaking in a top-down cosmos for generations. They have been living in a spiritual environment where the way that it works is that on the backs of all the populace who have to give their wealth to the spiritual leader takes all that wealth, and what they do with it is they mediate between the divine and the humans. So everything has to run through the leader at the top. That's the model. It's a top-down cosmos. Then they wander around in the desert for 40 years, having begun with this God is one, God's at the top thing, and they start to have all these curious experiences where that gets unraveled. And so I was thinking about the psalmist and their top-down cosmos, and I was thinking, you know, one way to read the Exodus story, which is a super important story in terms of the history of Christianity, among other things, is as a story in which that cosmos is starting to unravel. It's just starting. That divine mediated through one top human being to everybody else who pays that top human being, that model starts to unravel in the 40 years of wandering around. Because what happens is that as their understanding changes, they start to build the sorts of representative images, like a tabernacle, that say, oh, actually, God's operating on the same level that we are. God's in our midst. The story actually starts with a burning bush talking to Moses and saying that the ground that he's standing on is sacred. You don't get more on the same level as human beings than we're standing on the same dirt, can we chat? Which is one way to read the story of the burning bush. Right? So this whole thing is kind of getting unraveled as it goes. It's really intriguing. But it's turning into something that behaves a lot more like bottom-up than top-down. So let's just take that idea for a minute and reflect on what we've been talking about in terms of our brain's evolution. If we start to come at that from the bottom instead of from the top, one of the things we can see fairly easily is that what we call sin in a moral framework can really reasonably be thought of not as disobedience to a set of rules that are laid down by God, but as a consequence of evolution, as are the possibilities of goodness and love. So in other words, we've been considering this idea of morality being something that's unfolding from the bottom up instead of the top down. Let me unpack that just a little bit. Let's take our selfish instincts, for example. Our selfish instincts run in the background of what we might consider sinful behavior. It's kind of the self is kind of running around back there. Lots of thinking has been done about this. Those instincts are part of our brain structure, among other things. So, for example, survival as a species includes the will to survive even at the expense of others. This is necessary. It includes the will to control territory. It includes the will to go and take what we believe we need. It includes the drive to have sex and to reproduce. These things are all part of the oldest part of our brain. And it's not really hard to see how that part of our brain could get us into moral trouble, right? If we're just going to take what we want, and it's all about us, and we're not going to consider anybody else, is that going to create any moral conundrums? Do you think? Right? But that's the oldest part of our brain. That's how it's wired up. Now, the good news is that our brain evolution didn't stop there. More recent developments in our brain include things like the urge. So, like we have those other primal urges, we also have other urges, thank God. They include things like the urge to bond and to nurture, the urge to cooperate with others in pursuit of common goals, the urge to share resources, the urge to care for the needy and the vulnerable among us. They even include our inclination to wrestle with concepts that are as slippery as something like injustice and to try to make wrongs right. Those things actually are part of our brain function. So we've got these brains that are sometimes discernibly both primal and evolved, that are both oriented to the survival of ourself and to care for others. And I don't know about you, but some days I can feel the tension between those layers of my brain. Some moments I can feel it, you know? I find it intriguing in all of this, you guys, that our nearest genetic relatives, with whom we share an enormous part of our genetic makeup, to say the vast majority doesn't even come close. I mean, we have a couple of percentage points different from the great apes in terms of the genome. I find it intriguing that those beings behave in ways that include violence and aggression, easy to see, but they also object to unfair distribution of resources. They do favors even if there's nothing in it for themselves, and sometimes they're extremely empathetic. However, and it's an important however, all of those things that I just said about great apes, I didn't just find generically on the internet. They're from the work of a primatologist named Franz de Waal. De Waal would also say that despite all of those things being true, it is also true that there is little evidence that other animals judge the appropriateness of actions that do not directly affect themselves. In other words, animals don't make moral judgments, but we do. It's an important 2%. And if we put that information, that animals don't make moral judgments, but we do, we put that information into the symbolism of the Genesis story, here's one way to imagine it if you want. Imagine the tree, the fruit, this whole image of if you eat this, you'll be able to see the truth about the morality of the world. You'll be able to tell good from evil, okay? What the apes have done is nibbled on the apple. What we've done is eaten the apple and the branch and the trunk and the roots. We chewed up the whole damn thing and swallowed it. We got way more of the tree. The story doesn't become less vibrant because it becomes not literal. It just keeps informing our imagination about who we are and who we are relative to who God is. If we were to interpret what a primatologist like de Waal might have to teach us in religious terms, that image of the apes nibbling on the apple and us eating the whole thing, the whole tree, we could say that morality isn't a codified set of behaviors dictated by a God out there. Remember the ingesting part of that image? But an instinctive response to that of God, which is a Quaker phrase, by the way, so a Christian phrase historically, but an instinctive response to that of God which is in us. Go back to the ocean for a minute. We'll get there. Tim talked, when he spoke about the universe, he talked about this remarkable and beautiful image of God patiently waiting while we evolve. I was really struck by that. I'm going to add something to it. I'm going to suggest that we could add patiently inhabiting that evolution to our picture. And the reason I want to add that is because I'm picturing Tim's image from the vantage point of the ocean and the ship that I mentioned a minute ago. I'm imagining that this entire process of us evolving as moral beings happens within God. God's not somewhere else while we're evolving. Ship, bottom, ocean, remember that? This all happens within God. It's not like God's waiting for us to get evolved so they can show up. We're in God. We're evolving within that which from all things come and that to which all things will return. We're soaking in it, to use an old detergent commercial. When I imagine how this whole process happens within God, I find myself picturing how it might be the case that we humans can't seem in the final event to shake off our curiosity and about how that means that we keep giving the story that we have new shapes. We can't seem to stop doing that. I keep thinking, when I think about it from this perspective, I think about how dogma, which can be very stubborn, still seems to keep getting adjusted by new information and by the thought and the reflection and the exploration of those that are not afraid of uncertainty and the other costs that are associated with exploring what we believe, because it is, or can be, a costly thing to do. I used the image of lobbing grenades into the community with ideas like this when I was talking about this last week, and somebody said to me later, I don't feel like you're lobbing grenades, and they were saying of their experience, I don't feel like you're lobbing grenades. I feel like you take me to a door, and I can kind of look through the door, and then you push me through it, and then I swear at you. Exploring new ideas is not cost-free. When I think about explorers who had the courage to explore the story that we already have and to tell it in a different way, the towering figure for me as a follower of Jesus is Jesus. I don't think I know a bolder spiritual explorer in this story than that one. Having said that, I don't think that our moral choices automatically depend on our religious beliefs or affiliations. One of the most selfless human beings I know personally is an avowed atheist. Every time I'm with this guy, I think, I believe what you're saying about what you believe, because he's very articulate about it and very thoughtful about it and very gracious about it, but an avowed atheist. But when I watch you live, I feel like I'm watching Jesus. And I get that it's a perspective thing. I also know utterly self-absorbed Christians. In fact, I may be such a Christian. So what we affiliate ourselves with, what we say we believe, does not automatically dictate how we behave at all. And so for me, Jesus continues to represent my highest goals and my highest aspirations. Jesus continues to feel like there's the story that shows me a way to live that brings out the best of what can be in me and in the world around me. So that's the path I'll continue to pursue. It's the one I know. It's the one I have the best grip on. The beauty of this wider sort of perspective, this bottom-up perspective, is that I can be following the way of Jesus, or trying to do it, and along that path, I can learn from a host of others, some of whom will identify with Christianity, many of whom will not. But because I'm not looking at this from the top down, I'm looking at it from the bottom up, I'm seeing something that's widening rather than something that's narrowing, and that means I can watch for things that are good and true and lovely and right everywhere, and I don't have to start with a dogma at the top. I can start with the idea that we're evolving together. We have something to say to one another, with an idea like the Eastern idea that everyone can be my teacher. And I don't have to be afraid. I also don't have to stop passionately living my path. I just have to stop living it in a way that says, if you're not on it, you're dead already. That's top down, not bottom up. I stop learning as soon as I start thinking like that. I said in the blurb that I was going to connect this to driverless cars. Why do I say these things? So by way of both ending this talky bit and sending us out into the world to keep exploring, I'm going to briefly attempt to do that. So this past week, I heard this interview with Michael Sandel. Some of you all know Michael Sandel. He's basically a rock star philosopher. You don't find most philosophers on the internet, but like on YouTube, but you do find Sandel there. One of the reasons this guy is so well-known as a philosopher is because he has this tremendous ability to take these sort of esoteric problems that philosophers like to toy with and to connect them to everyday realities, and that's hard to resist, right? We know science people who do that too, and they kind of turn into rock stars. In any case, in this particular interview, he posed this driverless car dilemma. Imagine you and a passenger are in your driverless car. You're coming to an intersection. And there's this family of five. They're crossing the street against the light. Your car is not able to brake in time. Oh, any of you taking an intro philosophy class will recognize the trolley dilemma here, rewritten for a different technology. Should the car, so here's the question. Should the car be programmed so that it swerves to avoid killing the pedestrians, even if it means that it should crash into the concrete barrier beside the road in such a way that it kills the passenger in the car? As an extension of that dilemma, if you're out shopping for a driverless car, do you want to know how it was programmed to respond in such a situation? We're going to get to do this if we live well, okay? Like, this is not just esoteric philosophizing. This is morality plugged into the process of ethics, plugged into your car. Now, the reason I wanted to do that is because top-down morality says that the rule, thou shalt not kill, is the access point to resolving this dilemma. Yeah. We encounter the limitations of top-down moral thinking abruptly when we frame it like that. Thou shalt not kill does not resolve this dilemma. Because the question is not, is somebody going to get killed? The question is, who? And why? And how shall we decide? Well, we can add some complexity to top-down. We should add the rule that we should love our neighbor as ourself. An excellent rule. Way more complex than thou shalt not kill, which we already noticed is fairly complex. So we could do that. And it's not useless. This is not about binarizing this, although you have to illustrate it somehow, which is a limitation for me. Bottom up, just to wrap this up, bottom up moral evolution suggests that from go, the complexity of this problem is exactly the sort of thing that drives the evolution of our moral thinking and functioning forward toward wider possibilities. And not only that, bottom up thinking about moral evolution is that the ethical complexities and the tensions of an example like this are no more and no less than the kind of tensions that we wrestle with every day. It just sort of makes it more graspable as a problem to tell the story like that. But we have these kind of dilemmas writ large and small all the time. This way or that way. This decision or that decision. How come somebody gets hurt in both of these? How come it doesn't behave so tidily? It's like, everything's good if I do that, everything's bad if I do that. No, it's degrees of shitty sometimes. What do we do with those? Right? What do we do with those? If we understand or imagine that those kind of ethical complexities and tensions in an example like that are everyday tensions, sort of just made particular, and if we start to imagine that we're wrestling and grappling with all of this within God, rather than expecting God to sort of airdrop moral solutions into our world for us, it's a completely different frame. It's the frame we've been in that model, the whole time. And what's happened in that frame? Well, if you stand back far enough from it, what's happened in that frame is that our brain has evolved. And that we're no longer operating just with, I'm going to kill you and take your stuff. Right? I'm going to, before I kill you, I should think about the implications at least. Before I kill you, I should consider that the person whose spiritual path in which I strive to walk suggests that, in fact, I should love you, even if you have stuff that I feel like I need. If we think about this from the bottom up, all of those kind of complexities just start to, I think quite naturally, percolate through the dilemmas that we wrestle with every day. And we don't have to be freaked out about them because we're not actually trying to turn them into obedience to an airdropped, top-down moral framework. We are in the thick of God when we do that work, and we are evolving toward more and more complexity, including moral complexity, including spiritual complexity. All of it happens within God. That's a super important idea because otherwise we start to understand this as evolving to be God. Don't forget about the ocean and the ship. Of course, the way of Jesus adds in things to that, like ideas of self-donation, and other biblical writers further down the story add ideas like Paul's idea that to die is to live. If we're thinking about our electric car, that's an interesting thing to drag into the mix, isn't it? In other words, the way of Jesus adds complexity and ambiguity as well as beauty and hope. And that's full of rich possibilities. So, get out there, wrestle with that. Peace.